I just
get whipping.
Let it go. It's going now. I just turned it on.
Oh, I
man, I feel like I could go to Tootsie Roll and get a lot of Tootsie Rolls.
I think they should
have
buy a bunch of
I think it's lack of money. Figuring out the right amount.
She says, I told her,
what do we have the year before? Because the year before we had at least double that.
It wasn't, they weren't having packaged. I think that might have been part of the cost. Also, you can buy candy online.
No, isn't that?
And it comes in just a big bag.
Well, again, I don't think we're really that tight.
This is ridiculous. I was really embarrassed.
Yeah, I had really fun 2 to 3 times. That seems silly.
I would just like to prior to that comparison, you were before
we had. I even had a bag, a big bag of cookies. I didn't get permission. I was doing it. So, I'm going to mention it again.
The Star Trek too liberal?
Well, I guess I should mention it to all you guys. The ones that
are
here.
It came from San
Diego. Candy.
It's the law summary.
They did kind of support skin.
Candy for everyone.
Right. I don't think it was a last of fun.
Is that right? Well, I thought we
bought
it.
Especially the Sam's Club for a
while. We had to see. But it was the
but everyone had the year before. We had
let's get t-shirts. Let's shoot Rochester t-shirts.
But anyway,
we need to get rid of all of them. I don't know.
What are we going to say? We're for industrial size next year. It's over 500.
I would just like to see initially a comparison.
Thank you.
I'll ship it in $10.
Like I said, I don't think it's a lack of
I think you got to buy the phone, so not just go and buy
the phone. Only one thing a little awkward when they go to a
Where are you? You're so familiar.
Well, you just, nobody wants to talk to you. Like, are you in class? No.
So you guys have classes set
up? 140, 150, something. Most of them are there.
It's because they have a social life. They can't get very good.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. We'll go ahead and get started. I have a busy agenda this afternoon. First up, we have the Rochester Fire Department is going to talk about the clock tower. Chief?
I'll be as brief as I can. I think you all got a memo from me that kind of did a real brief synopsis of Bell. And we have an anonymous donor that's willing to put up $100,000 that would have to be matched dollar for dollar to relocate that clock and the bell and everything to Station 1, which isn't 100% historically accurate, but it's always been at the main Station 1. So we'd like to see it there. The city's investment in that would be the architectural services, which I'm guesstimating at this point is about a $6,500 on the design side. And again, this is all, because we don't have construction documents yet, but it's envisioned to be an approximately $300,000 project, so that would bring design and construction management and all that sort of thing to about $25,000. And again, these are kind of working estimates, if you will. The concept with the fundraising would be that it would be dollar for dollar match, and the Rochester Area Foundation would manage that for us. And let's see if I have my notes here. And what that would do is that would make donations to that tax deductible for businesses or individuals. And I believe there's some interest already from folks that have mentioned some of our firefighters and retirees were interested in making donations. So I think it might be a good community project to bring the clock back, bring the bell back to the station. And but the other packet of information I sent you, and forgive me for the size of these, you need glasses, at least I do to even see these, but the first couple ones were different. We don't have an actual design of the clock. These are just some ones, designs that our BKB worked on to give us some concept of what different things might be. One concept was to use that existing iron superstructure, which turned out not to be feasible, and just relocate it. Another one had it on the front entrance of Station 1, and another one had it across the street. What our donor would like to see is it right on the corner. That's that last sheet I handed out to you. So it would be right on the corner of 6th and Broadway. And that would allow the face of that clock to be seen from all four directions. And we would actually take out a couple of parking spaces there, but then replace them. There's a little grassy area there on the corner of the station, so it would be right at the corner. I did have a citizen send me a design which had a clock tower on a beautiful archway across Broadway, but it looked nice, but it would be very, very expensive, so.
All right.
I don't know if there's questions or...
So, I'm sorry, so what's the request from the city?
That we would fund the architectural services.
And the amount of?
Total, I'm guesstimating, would be about in the $25,000 okay. range. In the beginning of this first design phase, we're in the $6,000 to $8,000 range.
Okay.
The other thing is you'd be approving the location or putting it on the
fire station. City property, basically. So.
Okay. Well, it's pretty exciting to consider the proposal, so I'm anxious for some discussion. Mr. Goldbeck?
Yeah, I'm supportive of it. I think to put it back where it originally was is a neat idea. It's a neat historic part of Rochester. It would be great to have that back up there where it belongs. And so I'm supportive of it. Mr. Ruska?
Well, I'm supportive, too. I got some questions, though. I mean, you would start till you got the whole amount of money needed to do it, right?
We would need enough money to fund the project, correct.
Okay, and then one of the things that I've noticed in working at Civic Center over the years is the thing breaks down a lot. And,
yes.
And then it sits there and it doesn't work. And so is there any kind of a endowment or anything that we could use to make sure that there's proper maintenance and if it does fail, that it's fixed in a timely manner versus sitting there for a year?
Yeah, one of the things we talked about with the foundation is money raised above that amount would go into a fund to help maintain it. And we did talk to one of the gentlemen that had done some maintenance work on it, and he thought that with a little better design of some of the mechanisms, it would be less problematic. I guess there were some angles or universal joints in that pendulum setup that caused a little more maintenance. But again, that's not my area. That's what he indicated, that we had a straighter run between that pendulum and the clock mechanism that might lessen the maintenance on it. But.
So do you have an idea of timeline? I mean, is there any kind of an idea of how long the goal would be?
I think, as I recall from talking to these folks, we needed to raise the money and be ready to go by 2017. So.
Okay. Ms. Means?
I'm really pleased that the clock is being relocated back to its original place. Is it going to be refurbished, or is that not possible? Is it going to look the same as the other one?
Well, we don't have a design yet, but I think the intent was to have the faces of the clock visible from all four sides there at 6th and Broadway.
So the existing clock is not usable at all, it's obsolete, it cannot, is that...
No, I think it was working when they took it down. They had to move it because of the Civic Center project.
Yes,
so it was operational at the time. Now, however, the clock was is another matter.
Oh, the clock was just not accurate at all. I'm really
back in the day, that was the gold standard for time in the city, but I don't think that's true anymore.
All right. Anyone else?
So, maybe I missed this, but have we decided where the location would be then, or are we still?
That map, yeah.
It is the one on the corner.
Yeah, right on the corner.
My only issue with that was that I would certainly hope the future of this site is not a surface parking lot on a prominent corner in downtown Rochester, and I would just hope that if we're going to put this there, that we do that in such a way that it can be developed to a higher standard at some point.
Well, that parking lot, unfortunately, is necessary for staff parking.
Why is that? We've got parking ramps all over downtown. Why can't staff parking and parking ramp? It's a better use.
Well, it becomes an operational problem with what do they do with their gear. A lot of times if they're moving from station to station, and they have that in their personal vehicle. I mean, they park in a parking ramp and then carry it to the station or drop it off and make another trip. I guess I never thought that. I guess traditionally,
ultimately it's a matter of do you really feel that a surface parking lot is going to be on a prominent corner in downtown Rochester in 20 years? And I would say not if we're doing things right.
That's where the fire station is.
Yeah.
And it directly supports the operation of the fire station. So
would a parking ramp?
Where would a visitor park?
How many visitors do you get?
At that station, here's
the thing.
A significant amount of visitors.
They have other fire trucks coming out, training.
Tours and training.
Minneapolis has gone to aggressively get rid of surface parking in their community, particularly in prominent locations. And, there's lots of good alternatives.
Well, bring them. I'm looking for them.
We got a parking ramp.
Bring them. You can't park fire trucks in the ramp.
No,
the fire trucks come to train there. The fire stations from other locations come for training there. The police department comes to train there. There's many times that those training rooms are used for more members than just the fire department.
Right.
Those people need places to park. That's the fire trucks, ambulances, squad cars, and such.
So you're saying that they're using that surface lot for parking fire trucks?
Yes, they do. When they come to train there, they do.
No, they're temporarily in and out of that station during the day for different.
So, if you got alternatives, I'm willing to look at it.
There's the huge area behind it as well. I mean, what I'm just saying at this point is, let's not paint ourselves into a corner.
No, but I do believe this is a good location for this clock.
Yeah. You'll have to put lots of perennials and annuals in there, make it more beautiful.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I like the location on the corner, and I'm willing to take the chance. I think it's hard to project where this is going to be 20 years from now, but I think in the foreseeable future, this looks like a great location.
Mr. Campbell?
The total request today is just the $7,000, or is it the full $25,000?
No, I think that would be a subsequent one. This is just on the design phase.
Okay. And so we would wait until you've raised the rest of the money to put the rest of our... Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there consensus?
I'm outvoted here. I'm not supporting that location.
All right.
Short-sighted in my book, so.
Well, we have a bunch of short-sighted people around the table, I guess.
Well, I just think we're talking about the clock. Right now, that's where the discussion is. This is where this clock initially was at. I think it's important to try to bring it back as close as that possible, as where it was as possible.
Well, we've moved it before, and if we have to, we can move it again. This is a $25,000 study. We're not paying $300,000 to the city to relocate it.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll move on.
Is that $25,000?
Here we go.
Wait, it's $6,000.
Right. $6,000 for now.
We just said it's $6,000, right? I just want to make sure. Okay.
A six?
So, I thought it was 25.
They asked for 25, and then I just clarified.
So they'll come back.
They would
come back. I mean, this is early in the process. They wanted to get council on the loop on this early on. We're going to need funding just for design services at this point. We'll go off and raise some funds. And,
I think it's important that we see what the private market will support here, because we've had a lot of...
That'll be the key.
$6,500 design fee.
Okay, well, I just noticed your Mr. Quinville's memo here. It said $25 for the contingency. Yeah. So you're changing that then, Stephen?
Yeah, I thought it was a 25 for the whole thing. Okay. Greg says now he'd like to come back after the design.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm a little hesitant to, you know, the architect on this, you know, gave us, like, I had 8 hours of promo on work. I think it's probably more like 20, so he's kind of gave us a working estimate of the project. That was my main question, of what's it going to cost to do this, even if we have the donor money, how much more do we need to raise? So I think it'd be better to get the design done. We'll have a better handle on not only construction costs, but any cost for professional services. But $25,000, based on the conversation with the architect, should be somewhat in the ballpark, given the scope that I've outlined so far. Now, if that scope changes, of course, that number would change.
Thanks, Ms. Meek.
Well, I don't know. I would propose that we go ahead and put the $25,000 and have him take that money out of contingency as needed, rather than come back a second time. Or not to exceed the $25,000. I don't know why we do it in increments. Yeah. I mean, what's the advantage of doing the incremental steps?
No, my only thought was to be able to bring a design back to you so you could actually see something than what we were envisioning, but I'm okay either way.
I guess I would prefer to do the smaller amount just because there's a lot of people asking the greater community for funding right now, and we might find that, you know, we can fit it into next year's CIP instead of having to take it out of this year's contingency if it takes a while to pull a project together.
I'm okay with the incremental approach.
Yeah, so am I.
All right.
Good. Thank you very much.
All right. Mitzi Baker, looks like you've got the brunt of the rest of the agenda, multiple items.
Thank you.
I assume you want to take them one at a time?
Yes. So the first item before you for discussion is consideration of on-site public hearing notices. You might recall a few months back, we had a conversation about some ideas and things that we could implement that would help people in a neighborhood know if something's proposed on a property, even if they don't receive a notice. It's just another way to try to engage the community and inform as developments are proposed. So in your packet, you have Exhibit A, which is a draft ordinance proposal that would outline the requirement for the on-site public hearing notices. I have with an example of what that might look like. This is an 18 by 24 sign. The idea here is to have something that is manageable for people to pick up, to transport, and to install and uninstall and return, so that they don't have to have a pickup truck and, you know, extra muscles to take the stuff and move it out. There are different types of construction that we can be looking at. Some kind of a plasticized corrugated board is one thing. We've got some bids for commercial production of some of these. We think we're going to need to have 50 of them on hand just because of the fluctuation volume of public hearings and how many we might need at any given time. Another option is for the sign shop through Public Works to make them out of aluminum. Our thought is to have a kind of a construction yellow background with black ink, not just black and white. This is simply for an example for you to see. And you can see in the proposed ordinance that on properties that have frontage on multiple roads, or if they have real long frontage, there would be multiple signs, so that you don't end up with a 500-acre site with one little sign, which might be appropriate in the neighborhood, but in a greenfield development, that just doesn't suffice. I think our upfront cost for getting the signs produced and the stakes and so forth is probably around $700. So I just want to throw that out there so you're aware.
Quick question. Yeah. You know, we had requested, and I know you've been doing the more brightly colored orange notices. Have you had any feedback on whether that's helped or not? Because I know people were saying it got lost in the shuffle, and so we tried to do something more visual. And I know we talked about this as well, but I'm just curious if those in and of themselves have helped.
I will ask staff if they've had any direct feedback from folks on that. I hadn't heard any, and I'm seeing the heads shaking no. They're very bright. They're noticeable. So hopefully when they're coming in the mail,
I receive feedback. I received feedback from some people that had the before and after in the same neighborhood, and they said they greatly appreciated the bright color. So I've had some anecdotal evidence that it seems to work.
Mr. Bilbao? Sure.
Mitzi, I like the signs. What I do have a question is on, when you look at your proposed notice requirement, and it says 10 days. Can we get that to be 10 business days?
Well, this is following state statute requirements for public hearing notices. It's the same notification time frame that we're required to have as a city or county and others.
It's the minimum, right?
It is the minimum. To be honest, to keep things consistent would be the easiest to administer, and to try to add in business days as the requirement, I think it's a little tricky.
Well, it might be, but I'm looking at the fact, and I have gotten contact by some neighbors who have concern, because if you put it up on a Friday, or you put it up Thursday of this week, Friday the government offices are closed because of the 4th of July, that's 3 days, and you really got 5 days of next week, and then you're in a weekend again, and now your 10 days are done. So, excuse me, I was just, to make it a little easier, a little safer, if we put 10 business days, that would give everybody, should allow people who are off on vacation coming back, running to the holidays, to make it a more, and especially if the people want to get a hold of somebody or talk to somebody. My feeling is 10 business days makes a lot of sense. That may be a departure, but I think that it would help our citizens, and that's who we're trying to help here.
Well, and I will say the way that this is proposed is that the burden is on the developer or applicant to make sure they've installed and they've signed the affidavit that they've done it. So if you choose to do 10 business days, we can certainly put that in the language, and they'll just adjust the affidavit for them to make sure that they're committing to doing it that way.
Thank
okay.
You. Mr. Campbell?
So some feedback on the sign. Are we taking feedback on the sign today, or are you just looking to show us what you're going to do?
It's an example. If you have feedback, this is the time to get it.
Great.
To us.
The one thing I was going to suggest is maybe we do hanging numbers, since most of this is standard, like our 2015. If we're writing it on there, I think there's too much opportunity for it to not look clear. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the only piece of this that matters to me is our 2015-005 CUP and getting them to the website, because this sign alone tells them almost nada about our thing. So I'd like to make sure for our IT staff who are here too, putting in just our 2015-055 CUP on our website gets them to the proposal, regardless of, mm-hmm. I don't want them having to find it. That's way, mm-hmm. There's too many places to get lost on our website. If it's RochesterMN.gov or it's Olmsted County, putting it in either one of those should get them to the proposal. That should be expected of our website. Maybe one more click I could be bought on, but it should be the top hit. It should be obvious. So that's a piece that's really important to me. The other thing is that the email and the phone number are very, very small, too small in my opinion. A lot of this, like the site has a pending development application, I'd almost get rid of that to free up space. The notice of public hearing is the most important part of this to me. I heard a.
Well, you're assuming people kind of know what this is all about. Whereas someone who's not familiar with, the planning process, what's this sign all about?
Sure.
Just a thought.
Yeah, instead of public, maybe we could say notice of development hearing. I mean, anything that gets them to the website. But again, I guess I won't go redesign your sign, but the number one thing to me is that number has to be incredibly legible. It has to be linked immediately from the website, and the email and phone number have to be much more prominent, because if people call in, I don't care what number you put on there, maybe you put the council person in the area's phone number or something, but I think...
Put next on it.
Yeah, right. But I think the more phone calls we get ahead of the game instead of after the game, the less... Unless we have to deal with really distraught neighborhoods.
Well, and I will say, I think most people who want more information are going to the website. They're not calling. Our call volume has actually gone down since we've had more and more information available via the web. So I agree we need to change some of the language here, just to abbreviate. This, to me, is one of the most important pieces. Because the point here isn't to tell everybody what's proposed, but to direct them to new information that they can go and seek and get themselves. So we'll make some adjustments. Were there any strong preferences on material?
This is not a sign you're going to pick up everything on a drive-by. You're going to have to walk up to it and get the web address and so forth. I think the most noteworthy thing is if I've got a blank lot and suddenly this thing appears and I see notice of public hearing, that's going to catch my eye. But I agree with Mr. Campion that there's a lot of information there. I'm not sure exactly what I would remove. I'm going to have to walk up to it anyway to, you know, get the phone number and some of the other things.
I think you're right. I think our goal should be that either with my camera phone or with writing it down, I can capture the number that I need to look up on the internet. Because really, the number is the only thing that matters. If we can link you into the system, we'll get you to the application. You can.
Mr. Lorcus.
I was just assuming it was corrugated plastic, and can these be done in such a way where, you know, the only thing that's changing from development to development is that number, so are we just going to put a new sticker over it or something to so we don't produce signs every time?
We were trying not to get in the weeds on this today,
yep.
And really just show you an example. There are some fine details like that we have to work through, but the intent is that we can keep reusing these signs, okay. We're not printing new signs for every development, but that we can somehow come up with the mechanism for changing the development number.
Good. Perfect.
And we're trying to do that in a very clean and professional way.
I would get the rest of the sign printed by the sign shop on a really durable material. If it's corrugated plastic or it's aluminum, I'd be fine with either one of those options.
Titanium alloy.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Atkins.
I will get into the weeds because that's what I do for a living. The failure to file the affidavit 5 days prior to the first public meeting, what's the consequence for failure to do that? What are you asking? Oh, this is the planning. I see it says the applicant shall submit the affidavit no less than 5 business days prior to the date of the first public meeting. By the way, is that a public hearing before the council or the Planning and Zoning Commission or a neighborhood meeting or what is that?
That would either be the public hearing or the public review. Depends on what type and phase the project is. It could be a review of Planning Commission hearing or the council.
So it's either the commission action or the council action,
mm-hmm.
Not the neighborhood meeting.
No, so we are not requiring this for the neighborhood meeting.
And so that phrase public meeting is a little vague in landmine. But number, more importantly, what happens if they don't submit the affidavit? Does that public event before the Planning Commission or the Council occur?
You know, the very last sentence was intended to capture if there was a failure along the way.
Right.
But it does not specifically call out the posting of the notice. So.
Well, it says failure to maintain an on-site notification signage. Does that include the affidavit? Technically, I don't think it does. So what you might want to do is if a failure to comply with the requirements of this ordinance shall not invalidate an action.
We haven't sent this to you for review.
Yes, I know.
That's why the draft language is proposed.
But I can see somebody's going to ask if you were to adopt this and you have a public hearing and the affidavit's not posted or filed with by the 5th day before, does the public hearing proceed? Right now,
do we have other items that have a path like that?
No.
If you were to adopt the language that's suggested in the last sentence with my change, yes, the hearing would proceed.
So there would be no consequence. So why have the language at all? I want there to be a consequence. I think that if you lie or if you don't file it, I think there should be a consequence. So what are our options?
Actually be a political consequence in which the planning commission or city council could choose not to entertain that item that evening and continue the hearing.
They could.
Subject to.
Or they could not.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a chance for the city attorney's office to look at the language and maybe offer some suggestions.
Well, it depends. I need to know which way the wind is blowing here. If you want no consequence and simply that last sentence that you've made a good faith attempt, but you filed the affidavit 1 day before the public hearing, do you want to proceed or not?
Well, there has to be consequence.
Mr. Bildebeck.
I would like to see a consequence. I think the fact is that most of our neighbors are feeling that they've been short-sighted and got the short end of the stick on this anyhow. And I would like to think if we're going to do an ordinance, we'd have some consequences to it. Otherwise, why are we doing it? So my feeling is I would like to see consequences to the act. And if that means we don't hear their project because they haven't followed through and done what they were supposed to, then so be it.
Can I suggest, in that case, it's the filing of an affidavit. It doesn't mean that the sign wasn't posted in the proper time frame. It's simply filing the affidavit that they did it. So let's say they post the sign in the proper time frame. That's the real intent here, is to get the sign posted on the property. For some unforeseen reason, they can't file that paperwork with us until the day before the public hearing. Should they automatically be subjected to a delay? Or could it maybe be a sentence that suggests there may be a consequential delay?
Mr. Williams?
Can that affidavit read that they have been installed or will be installed within 24 hours, therefore they can sign it when they pick it up?
Well, we're trying to make this as easy as possible to pick up the sign when they file their application. Mm-hmm. Try to reduce the number of times people have to come back and forth. So hopefully they can come in, pick up that sign, they can email or fax in or mail in the affidavit if that's the most convenient.
All right. I understand what you were saying about the affidavit. What is most important to me is, did they actually put the sign in the location in the prescribed time frame? Whether they got the affidavit in saying, yes, I did it, I'm not as hung up on that. I would agree with you that there should be a consequence if they're not getting the sign up as laid out.
But, and I agree, but if we're asking, saying that they have to do this, this is what the ordinance says, then we should expect them to follow the ordinance. And if they don't, there should be some consequences. And if we're going to make some statement in the ordinance that there's consequences, it should be spelled out so they know what that is. I just don't, to me it doesn't make a lot of sense to put something in there that we don't intend to enforce.
You're saying consequences. Regardless of which part of it they...
If it says in it there's going to be consequences if you don't do it...
I agree with that, Mr. Campion.
Yeah, the language is clear to me. It says you'll get it in within 5 days. You know, I think it's completely clear. We're setting a clear expectation. The consequence should be equally clear. I would say it gets automatically continued until the next hearing or whatever the zoning administrator and the city attorney can work up, but I have no problem making the rules clear and the consequences clear. That's my entire life has been that way. And you don't park in a parking spot, you don't plug the meter, you pay the ticket. That's the way this thing goes. I mean, it should be no different.
Other comments? Ms. Means. So, what are we saying as far as the suggested language? I think Mr. Bildeback is saying that there should be some statement as to consequences if the ordinance is not abided by. Mr. Campion is saying it seems to be clear enough as presented.
Oh, sorry, no. I'm seconding Mr. Bildeback's motion.
Okay.
All third.
All right. So you want a statement in there that indicates that if there's non-compliance, there's a penalty.
Yeah, and I'm willing to say that it gets continued, but I understand for the penalty to be different.
Right. We'll draft something for consideration that addresses that. This has not formally been initiated by commission or the council yet.
Okay,
so
right.
We'll need to do an RCA.
You'll put an RCA in for next meeting? That'd be great.
All right. Anyone else?
We're going to see the RCA prior. We're going to send it out prior so we can see that all of those contingencies are and consequences are placed in after you've reviewed it with the city attorney.
It doesn't have to be for next meeting. I just realized that's like 4th of July, right?
There's another question I had about the departure from the timeline that you identified. I think it was a state requirement rather than the 10 working days. I understand the 10 working days, but does that get us into any complications because we didn't adhere to what they do at the state level? Or
no. No. We just want to have our own specific rule that it's a business day determination rather than a calendar day determination.
Sounds good.
I'll be honest, though, in terms of the two rules, I don't know the business day versus days makes as much of a difference to me because if it's displayed in public view, if it's displayed on a holiday or it's displayed on a work day, I mean, they're probably more likely to see it on a weekend or a holiday than they are to see it on a work day for the most part.
My only concern is to give them an appropriate time to call and
call
get back.
That's right.
If you're
okay.
going on vacation and say you're leaving Thursday and you're not going to be back for a week, or 2 weeks, and it was posted Thursday and you saw Thursday evening, Friday, Saturday, Sunday are weekends or holidays, and you got a week, and then you hit another set of weekends. That's 10 days.
You got it. No, I see your point now. Thanks.
All right.
I prefer to see 10 days. I don't think 10 working days are better. You're happy that one guy going on vacation for 2 weeks and don't see it. But I mean, you have to think about the process a little bit here, too. That could really drag it out in that week.
I think staff was asking for mercy when they said to keep it consistent, so I'll grant mercy.
State statute, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Okay. All right, so it sounds like all we're asking for is to tighten up that language so that it's clear that there's a consequence by not complying with the ordinance.
Did you go for 10 working days or just 10 days?
Ten days
in the statute.
10 days.
Right.
Keep that cleaner. That way.
10 days.
And if through the public hearing process the council changes their mind, you can always change it before the ordinance is adopted.
Yep. We get another crack at this.
Yes. Okay. So that was the first item. Thank you. The second item was prompted by some discussion about a Type 3 Phase 3 review. This is kind of a clumsy, cumbersome discussion, but when this current ordinance was developed, there was an attempt to identify a public review and vetting process that reflected something that was appropriate based on the type of proposal coming forward. Okay, so something that has generally compatible, but maybe some, you know, minor encroachment into compatibility might require a review. Things that are maybe more substantial and more significant changes of use or type on a property or intensity or density and so forth would require a much more intensive review process. Most things that require this Type 3 Phase 3 process, which is a review at Planning Commission and hearing at Council, most of those are a two-stage review process. So I come in with a preliminary plan because I want to do something. I invest in some level of consulting work in architectural design and site design, and I test the waters to see if this is an approvable idea. And if it is approved through that process, through the first stage, then I would go back and invest more intensely in the architectural and design standards and get more details put together and file that final plan review. So the intent is that the final plan review, there's been a pretty considerable vetting already. Now we're looking at the fine details. And the current process means that it's a kind of a check-off at the Planning Commission and a hearing at the Council. I guess the real question is that truly a problem, and does it need to change? I don't know. If I wasn't here when the discussion came up, so this is just here for discussion.
Mr. Wood?
Well, part of the reason it came up was it's... Because it's something that we haven't traditionally dealt with that much, because we really got in the habit of just universally waiving the final plat, which I think is a lot of times where this is coming up.
Plan, sorry.
When this came up, one of the things that happened is there was a note that went out that to the neighborhoods that even though it was a public meeting, it was not a public hearing, but the note said that it was a public hearing, and that's why. If we're gonna notice a public meeting, let's just have it be a public hearing so there's some consistency. It's one less thing to confuse neighborhoods on these things. And the other part of this too is that you know, we've all seen that the details and how you design these things tend to matter a lot more to the neighborhoods who are closely abutting these. This gives them an opportunity of planning if they can't make the council meeting. It gives them that other opportunity to be heard.
Other comments? Mr. Ruska.
I think the process we have now is pretty effective, and I don't really see a major reason to change.
So just kind of questioning, at one point you had mentioned some of the motivation was when the final plan was routinely waived, and I don't think we've done that lately.
Right.
Do you see it as much of an issue anymore, or is this...
Well, and it's more of an issue now because we never used to have these Type 3, there's Type 3 Phase 3, right? That this applies. When we were waiving the final plan, that never came into play. But now that we're not waiving the final plan, now it's going back to planning and zoning. And that's where we would be having a hearing now. And whereas currently it's a public meeting. Is that what it's called?
It's a meeting. It's public.
It's an agenda item on the public.
Technically, a publicly posted meeting, public official meeting, and it's their review of the item.
So we're actually making this opportunity occur more now because we're letting them the plan go through separate.
But it seems like they're still going to have their say at the council, right?
They would.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Campion.
I guess I would, you know, having served recently on the Planning Commission, I would support the change merely because I think it gives another opportunity to maybe to get the developer and the neighborhood talking, make sure that they've got their ducks in a row before we get back to council. You know, if there's, as we saw recently, I think after our six-hour session, if there's any opportunity to get the developer and the neighborhood on the same page before getting the council meeting, you know, I think that that's something we should embrace here. If we're already going to be doing all the staff time and staff review preparation to have it at the Planning and Zoning Commission, I think it's worthwhile to, have them, hear the public's opinion at that point and make sure that's there. I guess the question I would have outstanding here is, have you surveyed the Planning and Zoning Commission for their thoughts on whether that's a productive change here?
We have not. This was something I understood came up at a council discussion, so we brought it to you for discussion to see if it even warrants any further work. I will say one thing with the public hearing process is, when there are significant differences between a developer and their proposal in a neighborhood, 3-hour public hearing at Planning Commission isn't necessarily going to negate a 3-hour public hearing at the council. So
it's fair.
If you open this up to being a public hearing in both settings, it may just be more public hearing time.
Mr. Bildebeck?
Yeah, I do support it. I do believe that in many of the cases, even when we hit the very end, had there been more opportunities for the public to have a conversation or make those conversations. I think we've seen how many times plans have changed drastically between public planning, zoning, and before it gets to council. And I think more opportunities that they have to have input and vet are good opportunities, and they're not wasted time.
As I read through this and listening to the discussion, the thoughts that occurred to me at one, every time we have developers, and often, more often than not, their legal counsel present, that adds to the cost of and time for the project. Having said that, though, I'm also very cognizant of the time that it seems to be taking at the council. We get into some very protracted, almost negotiation sessions, whereas maybe with another public hearing, let some of those details be fleshed out so that ideally when it gets to the council, it should be much more straightforward. And as an aside comment, one of the things that I often wish that could be shared more so with the development community is not to be so repetitive. I mean, we've all sat through literally hours-long presentations of information that we've already read in our packet. So mm-hmm. I think there should be some give and take here. The public hearings, I think, would go much quicker if people were more efficient in how they presented their information. Give us the highlight or, the salient points that you're trying to make, but gosh, don't go through everything that we already read as a byproduct of the Planning and Zoning Commission meetings and then certainly in our preparations for the council. So I can support it as long as, we look at the process in total, and I think we can make it more efficient, and then maybe we won't have 4- and 5-hour council meeting. Mr. Campion, then Mr. Lord.
I completely agree with that point, to the fact that, I told some of the neighbors after a recent decision that didn't necessarily go the way most of them wanted, that, the lesson I walked away with was, if the council is hearing testimony until 1 a.m, it can feel like you're rushed to build the legislation, and you can be rushed to, make decisions that are going to have really significant ramifications. So I think that there's any opportunity we can have where, one, you give the opportunity maybe to winnow those arguments down to the core, to what really matters for both sides. So the arguments are coming in a little bit more crisp to the council, and then we can, make sure to leave that time, and it benefits everyone to have time up there to make the decision and make sure you're making the right choices as you go forward. I just think it's I think it would be a good move for us.
One example where something this worked really well, and I would hope to see more of this, was when the large mixed-use building that we're doing on Broadway Center came forward. If you remember what happened, there were some issues of planning and zoning. There was a hearing, some things were brought up, and rather than just forcing it through, they continued it for one meeting, and all the issues got worked out. They were relatively small. I believe it passed planning and zoning unanimously the next time, passed the council unanimously with not a lot of contention. That's not going to work all the time because you have to have two parties that are willing to work together. But boy, it's a nice tool to have when it will work. And that's what the hearing allows them to do.
Mr. Hagan?
I guess if they didn't have the opportunity at the council meeting, we were actually losing an opportunity to speak, I would be more supportive. But I think given that opportunity, it's going to come to the council anyway, so I would stick with the existing process.
All right. Ms. Mead.
I like the idea of having a public hearing also at the planning and zoning because oftentimes they're able to work out things with the developer prior to getting to the council. And then if we had, someone speaking for the neighborhood, two or five people speaking for the neighborhood rather than each individual, that would sort of cut down on the time as well. But I think if the public wants to speak at the planning and zoning hearing, that they should be able to be there and work out some of the issues that we end up making decisions at the council chambers that probably could be alleviated if they were worked out at the planning and zoning.
Well, and let me be clear. I was supportive. I can support the idea of the additional public hearing so much as there's a value add. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want it to be another verse of the same song. And by the time it gets to the council, I'd rather that we're not debating brick versus stone. Mm-hmm. Let that stuff be handled at the advisory level. So if it makes the overall process more efficient, then perhaps it won't be a cost burden for the developer, because they get the details ironed out before they get to the ninth inning.
And prior to getting to the planning board, what did you mean? Explain what you meant by at the advisory level.
At the planning zoning commission.
Oh, yes.
The additional hearing that we're talking about.
Yes, exactly.
I agree. It's already a checklist. I mean, all we're really doing is saying after the council has given direction in terms of the direction for the city, you can open this up for public hearing. We will already have weighed in one way or the other and take more public feedback, knowing the direction the council's leaning. I think it's a good thing.
You still will have the situation, perhaps, where the developer won't agree with the planning commission's recommendations, and you'll still have that discussion at your level.
Sure. Yeah. So we'll continue to have those.
All right.
So what is kind of the consensus on the table as far as change or no change?
Change it.
Change. No change. Change. Change.
Public hearing both places.
Change.
Yes.
No change. So it would seem like the consensus would be to consider the change, and which would add the additional public hearing.
So in other words, you're kind of obliterating then the type 3 phase 3 process.
Right.
You're eliminating that.
It would eliminate that. There right. would no longer be that process in the
right.
Plans.
You wouldn't need it anymore.
Those would become type 3 phase 2s.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that there are other parts of the ordinance that do refer to type 3 phase 3s that have nothing to do with incentive and restricted development. So that still should remain part of the ordinance.
So this has to
type 3 phase
2. This comes forward as a text amendment, right?
It will come forward as a text amendment. So the first step is to have the council initiate it, and then those other details or things we'll have to bring forward to the Planning Commission Council.
Yeah. Speaker, I wonder, do you see this, and I think if the public wants to speak at both hearings, that's fine, but is this, do you think this increases efficiency by having it the public hearing at the planning and zoning, or do you think it would be more burdensome to the commissioners?
Do you want the honest answer? honest or the political answer.
Always the honest.
Yes.
I don't think it increases efficiency. I think it simply extends the amount of time that people are expected to spend in public hearings to voice their concerns.
Mr. Have you got any feedback from the Rochester Builders or the Chamber on, because this could affect the process and the timeliness of developments?
I have not. I had contact with them today and assured them that we would be sitting down to go over this so they understood what it was, and they also understand there's a public hearing process that has to happen before these things can be changed, and that they would be part of that.
Okay. Thank
you. Mr. Hagen? Thank you. Mr. Arbush, had a question?
I just had a wanted to clarify, since most of the discussion was about the two-phase process, did you want to potentially just limit the discussion to that type of activity? As John mentioned, some applications are only a type 3, phase 3. They aren't a two-phase process. Do you really want to drop the type 3, phase 3 from the zoning ordinance, or do you just want to make sure that everything that's a two-phase process has a hearing at the Planning Commission on the second time around?
What are the other items that come through Type 3, Phase 3?
Mostly stuff that has to do with floodplain.
Okay.
Things yeah. like that, DNR
and permits. And I guess I wouldn't be so interested in that as much. You know, what this is really about is this is about the incentive and the restrictive, the ones that tend to be more sensitive for me. That's my take on that.
I agree. Yep. Wholeheartedly. That's the ones that we get the contentious spots on. So.
And focusing on those two types of applications.
Sounds like it. All right. And again, we'll get another shot at looking at the language and consideration. All right, moving on.
Next item. You might pick up that there's a bit of a theme here having to do with the advance notice of neighborhoods and the attempt to provide for opportunities for developers and neighbors to have their conversations in advance of filing formal applications and try to avoid edits and changes to their proposals once the formal application is submitted. So we are suggesting, this is not something that was asked for, it's just something we've identified as a need. We're suggesting that there be consideration for the required neighborhood informational meetings. There are some types of applications that require a developer to hold an informational meeting with a neighborhood, and others that don't. And the focus here is the kinds of developments that come forward for public hearings. There's a discrepancy in some that require that neighborhood meeting and some that don't. We're simply suggesting that we close the loop on that, and that anything that comes forward to you or the Planning Commission for public hearing requires that they have this neighborhood informational meeting. Okay? So that's closing the loop. The other piece, and I would say that does not include right-of-way or utility vacations. That's a process that's not even in the zoning ordinance. That's a separate thing. I'm talking about development proposals. The other piece of this is the timing of the neighborhood informational meeting. In order to really provide the neighborhood and the applicant the best opportunity for making changes to their proposal if they wish, we prefer that that happens before they file their application. And I think you've seen several examples in the last year where an application's been filed. There have been additional interactions between neighborhoods and developers, and then the application gets changed, resubmitted to us. It's partway through the process, and we, on the fly, have to change, you know, sort of how we're reviewing or try to review that thoroughly and still get it to you. You're not always seeing the Planning Commission's review of those things either. So a suggestion is that those neighborhood informational meetings should actually occur prior to submitting their formal application to the city.
Okay. Well, that would potentially save them time and money.
Could be all around.
Mr. Campion.
I was going to ask. I mean, this kind of got me thinking about, and we've had it in multiple meetings where the planning department gets something with the full time to review, and then a few days beforehand, there's some, you know, what I gauge to be pretty significant changes, and then we have to kind of rerun the process before the meeting. Do you see this working against that? I mean, this still kind of seems to leave the door open for things changing. It's just saying, before you do an application, we're going to expect that you've met with the neighborhood, and you're taking that into account before submitting it to us. Is that
right.
correct?
I don't know that we can ever eliminate those mid-process changes from happening. Yeah. But my hope is that they could be reduced by having that interaction early and prior to submitting the application to us.
You don't have the pre-development meeting until after the application is submitted, right?
We have it before.
You do have it before? Because, I mean, ideally, it'd be great to actually have that interaction with the neighborhood before that pre-development meeting so everyone has their eyes on the prize at that point.
Yeah, from the developer's perspective, to see if there are any changes they would choose to make. I prefer our staff not be part of that political process and that they be able to be objective and professional in their review.
But what about that? What about the timing, though? I mean,
the timing. I think again, the neighborhood informational meeting.
Yeah, if you put that before the pre-development.
Sometimes they're so speculative, though, and those pre-development meetings might be a project that never goes forward. They may learn things at the staff level about the logistics of utilities and services and ordinances and policies that completely change their proposal. So.
Yeah, I tend to.
I don't know.
I was leaning the other way. I was going to say put it after that because sometimes the staff comments, the professionals that we pay to do this stuff, will so change a product that by the time it gets to the neighborhood, it's not even the same thing.
Well, that's a good point. I accept that. Very good.
Other comments? Mr. Bilderbeck.
Mitzi, the only question I have is for you after the pre development meeting, if it was fast track, I'm just trying to get a ballpark figure here. If this was on a fast track, how fast would that come forward to plan to get some final plans to go to the planning development or planning zoning or being ready to go after the pre-development meeting?
Yeah, there's so many factors that come into that. Yeah. We could have a pre-development meeting with somebody and it'd be 9 months later until they come back.
Right.
You know, whether it's their banking and financing issues or they're trying to figure out exactly how to cash flow the whole thing and how, you know, evaluating their business plan. There's so many factors, I don't know that I can give you an answer on that.
But it wouldn't be,
like, it can't
a month later, typically it wouldn't be within a month or.
Honestly, it varies so much. It really varies so much.
That's fair. That's fair.
I think that's a good point, though.
Yeah. One of the things we're looking at is to say that there's a 90-day time frame involved in this, so the application, and then take the clock back 90 days, and that window is when the neighborhood meeting would occur. So if you have one of those that's 9 months or 12 months or whatever, you wouldn't have had that 11 months ago, and then kind of whatever would happen, happened. So we kind of try to keep it in line, but there are a lot of variables involved.
Well, that's fair. The thing that occurred to me when I first read this, and I focused on the left column of that table, and that seems to be when we get into most of the discussion. Anytime we're changing the land use, changing the zoning, or at the GDP level, that's when most of the shock value happens. You know, people didn't know that that was going to happen. So from that standpoint, I could appreciate making sure that we have neighborhood meetings when those actions are happening. That was just my initial reaction as I read through this, as opposed to why we selectively pick, you know, the core neighborhood, for example, versus other zones. You know, why not just make it consistent? Mm-hmm. Other comments?
Something ancillary related, if you will. Just the one thing is the meeting time and location. I think it's important that we allow the council members to be present, so I would be in favor of maybe preventing these from happening on nights where there's a council meeting. I've had ones that have worked the same night as planning and zoning, and even that was a little bit of a challenge if I had an item at planning and zoning to get there, but I can deal with that. But I don't think it should be the same night as a city council hearing. If we can put that into language, I think that'd be a fix so that we can be present instead of having to hear about it secondhand.
Mr. Newman?
Don't really care how you decide this, but it does move it up further in advance of the judgment you made on the, you know, the signed notification. So you're moving it more instead. You know, now it's probably closer to that 10-day notification period. Now you could be moving it forward. I just point that out. I don't know if that makes any difference to you or not in your judgment.
But Sarah, can you clarify that?
If they're doing it before they submit the formal application, you moved it up the meeting with the neighbors much earlier in the process. That has its some advantages, but it also pushes it further away from that 10-day signposting notification when, and it would be in advance of that anyway, but it, at least the two are a little closer together. I mean, but
all right, other thoughts? And to Mr. Newman's point, I mean, we do have to be careful of the Hunziker rule of unintended consequences. I just had to get that in there for Terry's benefit.
I remind him of that all the time.
Yep. That we could create some additional delays, and then, you know, you run into some barriers, you know, 90-day barriers or whatever else. And as I said with the earlier proposal, you know, if this adds value, if this cleans up the process so that it goes more smoothly, then I'm all for it. But to add a meeting for the sake of a meeting is not good. Mr. Wojcik, you just...
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the points you're making. I do think it's critical to have, in those cases, you know, the contentious ones that you've listed earlier, we should have the neighborhood meetings. I personally think the earlier the better. But Gary's point's valid too, that, you know, if you get it too far from when they're posting and when something's happening, it can get a little confusing as well. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm not as married to the timeline as much as I'm just married to the fact that we actually have these meetings.
Okay. Mr. Campion.
So one question I get here is there a way to take the, and this is going to seem wide-ranging, the number or designation on the sign and figure out when and where the public hearing or the neighborhood meeting would be held?
We don't have responsibility for the notices for those neighborhood meetings or for the arrangement for where they are and how they're held and where they're held. And that is very purposeful. It's intentional.
Yeah, I get that is intentional because you don't want to be in that process, but it ends up putting the council members in a bad spot too when we get the thing and says, I never got the notification. I mean, then we have nowhere that we've kept track that they've been notified. I mean, we basically take the word of the developer, right, that they've sent them out. And I had one last week where, or 2 weeks ago, excuse me, where it was raining cats and dogs, and then afterwards I got, you know, I didn't get a notice. I saw this on your Facebook page instead of through the official channel. And then it's, you know, are we all supposed to be finding everyone in our ward on Facebook and trying to let them know? I think that not being more in this process, you know, also opens us up to some additional criticism, frankly, that, you know, how do we know these meetings are happening? How do we know people were contacted? How do we manage that going forward? I realize that the staff time would be immense. I'm just trying to see if there's any outside-the-box ideas on that one.
Well, I think in most cases the neighborhood groups will be very honest in letting us know whether the meetings happened timely enough or that enough people were notified.
Is there a checklist where the developer can actually check that this has been accomplished?
So you don't. That's not a checklist.
Mr. Atkins?
There's a section that spells out what must be in the application, 60.504. So if you were to go down this road, I would suggest that section be amended to require the application form to note the date and time and location of the neighborhood meeting, so that if it's obvious from looking at the application form it did not occur, then it can be ruled by the zoning administrator as incomplete and will not be accepted.
Okay. Yep. That works.
All right, so where are we at on this one? Mr. Miliband.
I support the neighborhood meetings. I guess the timing and the other issues I'm not so worried about. I just think that it's important to have a neighborhood meeting.
All right.
I would support the neighborhood meetings and in line with the recommendation of the staff after the pre-development meeting.
Mr. Campion?
I would also support it with maybe the minor change of trying to make sure we're not meeting on nights where there's council meetings.
Mr. Wojcik?
Support.
Ms. Mead? Mr. Ruska? All right. All right, I'm okay with it as well, so we'll give it a shot. Again, we get a chance to look at the revised text and All right.
So you'll see some RCAs coming forward.
Wait, with me?
That, the city attorney just mentioned that application form. You know, the entire application. That would be good. That's going to be included. Right.
It becomes an element of the application.
Good.
Right.
So those details will come forward to you, but first you'll see an RCA to formally initiate these changes. Once we have them drafted, we'll work with the attorney's office and schedule public hearings with the city council. And in that process, the public and developers and anyone who wishes to be part of that process will join us. The last item for discussion that we have today is a zoning study of properties along 2nd Street Southwest. And the outlined area here is the study area. We were asked to take a look at this area as a potential for rezoning all of what's in the black outline area to the B2 zoning district. Could you go to the existing zoning map? These are the existing zones within that. The red is the B4. Lighter yellow is going to be R1. And then there's some R2, R3 in orange. And then there are several PUDs actually out in this area. I think there are two. I'm just going to turn it over to Jeff Ellerbush. He led the study out here, and there was a meeting with some of the property owners as well. So I'm just going to turn it over to you.
This is another set of handouts that are a little bit more detailed than the one I provided prior to the meeting. Do you go back to the
tape? You want the aerial?
Yep. So this is the aerial photograph. North is the top. These things are Cascade Lake in construction. To the north, this is 2nd Street, or turning into Country Club Road, right through the middle of the site. Far western edge, that's the Mayo parking lot. Big chunk. On the south side, far western, inclusion in the study was the tennis club, indoor tennis center. And then on the east side is Highway 52. The north boundary is 1st Street Southwest, public road that goes through this point through the West Umbro Addition, and then is followed along south of the senior housing complex. And on the south side is 3rd Street Southwest, over to 23rd Avenue, and then following the property lines of those businesses that front along 2nd Street. This is the land use plan for the area, the colored map. The colors on the map indicate land use designations. Red is commercial, green is recreation space, kind of the light orange is medium density residential, and the buff color, the tan color, is low density residential. What I'd like to point out on this map is the portion of the site along the north side of 3rd Street Southwest, in these two locations, it's basically residentially developed properties, and they're still designated for low-density residential on the land use plan. If the goal is to rezone the area to B2, those areas we recommend be changed from low-density residential to commercial, to conform to commercial zoning in the future.
Sorry, can I just get you to go over that one more time? It's already commercial or already residential?
It's residential now.
Okay, that's right, okay.
It's in the study area. You can see how the study boundary was coincident with the land use designation of commercial, which extended all the way to the 1st Street north. 1st Street Southwest side on the north side of the project. On the south side of the project, 3rd Street was the logical boundary. 3rd Street would be necessary to promote commercial development or mixed-use development, redevelopment of this area, because it's the way that people would be getting in and out of the area. So one of our recommendations, no matter what happens out of this, the concept is to have a commercial corridor through this area, that these two locations should be initiated for amendment of the plan from low density to commercial. As Mitzi pointed out, there's multiple zoning districts in this study area. From starting on the west side, planning and developments are specific zoning districts that were established on the property under prior zoning ordinances and carried over into our present zoning ordinance. They're site plan approved zoning. The only thing that they can do on those properties is what the plan says. So the plan's on file in our department, and that's what regulates the use of that land, not the tables in the zoning ordinance.
Similar to a special district.
Very similar. The multifamily zoning on the north side of the road is the Granville at Cascade Lake area through here, the newest apartment complex that's out in the area. There's a couple of different commercial zoning districts, a B5 in these two locations along the south side of Second Street, that's the office building. It was built about 3-4 years ago, and this is a little, the old, it's going to be a new office building that's it's under construction, beginning to be under construction, it's about the time. The R2 zoning district is found along Second Street, along Third Street in this location. These properties on the corner of 23rd Avenue and 2nd Street are condominiums and apartment houses. They're fourplexes. They're built very close together. They aren't going to redevelop unless they redevelop as a single piece of property because they share access points and they have multiple owners. They're fourplex units. Half of them are owned by and act as apartment houses, and the other half are condominiums where they have multiple owners. That'll get to the story that we had. We decided, since this is a study of an area, the eventual action would be the city council's action to rezone the property. None of you have experienced the activity of doing that yet. Looking around this is a table. As long as I've lived here, it's hardly ever been done where the city council is the initiator of the rezoning. But that's what we'd ask out of this activity would come forward. The rezoning of the property would be initiated by the city council and decided by the city council. So we decided that we did the zoning study, we should treat ourselves kind of like developers, so we held a neighborhood meeting. We actually held a neighborhood property owner meeting, since there's a significant number of property owners that would be affected along this corridor anyway. There's 112 or 115 properties, and there were 73 property owners of those 115 properties. They all received a written notice and a nice colored map like this in the mail, in an envelope, not just a brightly colored piece of paper, but they had an envelope with a little letter and a picture inviting them to this meeting, which we held on June 2nd. Carl Burhoff, staff planner, assisted at that meeting. We held it at the in the area, in the community room of the Masonic Lodge. We had 12 owners sign in our sheet. I'd like to point out that out of those 73 owners that we sent, we received about 12 of them back as incorrect address. Those came back to us in the mail. Kind of surprised. You know, out of 73, we almost had a quarter of them, over 20% return, saying undeliverable. Mm-hmm. And that's the address that we use comes off of tax targets. A lot of people make some movements around here. A lot of properties have changed hands.
But they're current on their taxes.
They are the people. But so we held that meeting. We got input for the meeting. I've included in everything I've sent to you, the previous memorandum one now. We received a letter from Jamie Shannon, representing from Hamilton Real Estate, and owners involved with the Highwell property, their concerns. At the meeting, mostly had to answer a lot of questions about what will this do to this and why are you doing it. And boy, I had to pay a lot for assessments and that kind of stuff. Nobody else basically said anything that were indicated they were greatly in favor. A couple of property owners just really questioned why we were doing it at all, how it would help them. What should we do? I've already suggested that we should amend the land use plan because it's obvious that those areas along the south side of the study area should be shown for commercial. When looking at this area, the most important thing, a different thing that's happened since the land use plan was adopted is that the city is in the process of just finishing up the total reconstruction of 2nd Street. It used to be a county road, became a city road. Now you've developed it as a very beautiful, pedestrian-oriented, walkable, urban cross-section from Highway 52 to 23rd Avenue. From 23rd Avenue West, that section of the road is still more suburban or rural in character. It has bike paths on either side, but it has large boulevards because it has ditch sections. And the character of the road changes at 23rd Avenue West. So, from the staff perspective, we feel that the change that's happened in the area is between Highway 52 and 23rd Avenue. From 23rd Avenue West, there hasn't been change that would suggest that we should be changing the zoning of the area from R3, R1, and B4, R3, PUD, and R1 in this area. So we'd recommend that you limit your consideration of initiation of changes to 23rd Avenue back to Highway 52 if you intend on doing it at all. The other thing we'd recommend is that the PUDs within this that portion of the study area, these three in this location, not be changed because they're important documents that apply specifically to their property. There's no reason to change the zoning on their property since it won't change. Those properties are relatively all new and they don't have any high potential to redevelop, so why change them? Residentially zoned properties in this study area, along here, 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 and here, are owned, majority are owned by the people who live in them, or the people who own them to rent. Some of them have been purchased by some of the property owners adjacent to commercial areas, but at this time, B2 zone that you requested to be evaluated here is a new zoning district, and it's added to the zoning ordinance when we kind of adopted the active living aspect to our land use planning process and promoted complete streets. The B2 zone was a district added to promote that kind of land use. And that's why we think it is generally, as a district, an appropriate use in this area between 52 and 23rd Avenue, because this street promotes that kind of land use, active land use, active walking, biking, and that kind of thing going on in this corridor. We're trying to promote that. But in the areas where it's presently zoned residential, those are houses. The B2 zoning district has handed out the information. Carl prepared a memorandum that we provided to the property owners at the meeting that night, showing what's the difference between the B4, the majority of the commercial area, and the B2 district. The B2 district does not allow single-family homes or duplexes. And these areas where the presently zoned residential have single-family and duplexes in. Don't see any reason to make those folks non-conforming. Doesn't change their life. They'll be able to live in their house. Nobody takes their house away from them. But if somebody asks the question, I've got a house, I want to buy it, what's it zoned? We tell them, if we change their zoning to B2, we'd say, well, B2, that's a commercial, pedestrian commercial zoning district. Are houses permitted? We'd say no. Well, what's that mean? Well, that means if it burned down and didn't rebuild it in an appropriate amount of time, you couldn't build it back at all. So it just raises questions in people's minds. It's hard to refinance your properties. We answer lots and lots and lots of public questions about what is my property zoned. Giving them an answer that it's not zoned the district that allows their use isn't a good thing to give them. So these areas, we think you could wait on these until the property owners themselves have a desire to change the zoning on their property, because they will have negotiated either a deal to sell their property, and that can be done at that time. So again, focus on the red area within the boundary, that commercial remaining area, which is B4. I will point out there is one little exception. There's a little piece of R1 land here. It ended up that way because it was annexed later than everything else in the area, but it's a little duplex in a former commercial building that used to have a pet shop or something like that, I think. It's zoned R1. This piece of property should not be zoned R1. It should be zoned the same as it is on either side. So we'd recommend that consider an amendment to the zoning ordinance to initiate our B2 zoning in this area, that you include this one section of R1 zoning.
Jeff, before that came into the city, it was actually zoning highway commercial in Olmsted County.
Right.
You recall that. So.
Yep. We pointed out in the memorandum that there are some land uses that would be affected by changing the zoning of their properties. Some of the land uses within the B4 area, a few of them, the muffler shop would not be a permitted use any longer if you zoned in B4, permitted in the B4, or excuse me, B2, permitted in the B4, not in the B2. There's a couple of properties that could be affected by hours of operation. They might be, again, non-conforming. The uses in a B2 zoning district have shorter hours of operation, so they're not open late at night. Quick Trip and the restaurant bar Beatles could be affected. They probably operate right now and be non-conforming, but the limitation is to 11 o'clock at night on businesses to be open in the B2 zoning district. So I'll point out that those would be some changes. The last thing I want to point out is that although this is a supportive area for the B2 zone along a really nice, our newest corridor in town, the B2 zoning district is, the way it's drafted, is very, very similar to the B4 zoning district. Exactly the same in off-street parking requirements. So the same amount of off-street parking is required in the B2 zone, for a business as it is in the B4 zone. I took one of the pieces of property that's totally vacant. There's a lot right here in this, on the south side of 2nd Street, just to the west of the liquor store, more or less, and west of Saturday Allen's place, if you remember where that is. It's 15,000 square foot, 100 foot wide, 150 foot deep, has actually access to an alley off the back. Really, really a prominent thing to have. And laying that out, you can fit about just the dimensions of the lot determine how many parking spaces, surface parking spaces you can fit. You can fit about 27 coming in off the back of that alley. You can fit 27 parking spots on that. That parcel, that vacant parcel, could have a 4,000 square foot retail space on it with 27 parking spaces. That's the zoning requirement in the B2, the same as it is in the B4. If it's a restaurant, you could only have about a 3,000 square foot restaurant. Restaurant parking is calculated a little different standard, a little higher standard, so the building would have to be smaller. And if it were an office building, it could actually be a little bit bigger. It could almost be a 2.5-story office building if it wanted to, because the off-street parking requirement for office is less than it is for retail or for restaurants. Point is, parking determines how much you can build on the properties in the area, not the zoning. The only way that you actually build something bigger is if you can build underground or underbuilding parking. And that's really expensive to do. And it's not in place in any place this far west of downtown. In fact, that would be the only way that you utilize this land at a higher intensity with meeting the same requirements for off-street parking is that if you found a different way to park, a much more expensive way to park. Everybody debates and knows about the cost of building a parking ramp space or an underground space that can range between $20,000 and $30,000 a space. If you build a parking that's expensive, you have to build a pretty big building on top of it to make it pay. The height requirements in the B2 district are similar to the B4. It's 35 feet maximum height. So if you put parking under a building, you're going to have to go higher than 3 stories to make that parking pay. And then also go forward and put it elevated inside the building because it's a multi-story building. So the point is that zoning is not going to be the B2 district is not going to be the winner chicken dinner for this area. Just because you zone it that way, that all good things are not going to happen. Almost every development application will be the same as you see them right now. They'd be coming in for incentive developments, restricted developments for uses maybe that would not be permitted in the district, or they'd be seeking some sort of parking change or parking variance. Because doing development in this area really and providing the off-street parking is the thing that shapes the character of the development. You know, it's like developing anywhere else. I looked at the area. The walkable area of this neighborhood here is about 1,800 housing units or about 3,300 people, which is about the size of Pine Island. But that type of walking area doesn't support this much commercial use. This commercial corridor relies on people all over the city to do business here. Office business, doctor business, restaurant business. They still have to come into the area and park. A lot of people do. It is close enough to downtown that things in the future, different types of access, traffic, and transportation may be available along this corridor. But right now, you still have to rely on cars. If all the cars have to be parked on their own private property in the commercial districts, it makes it really hard for redevelopment to happen in reality. If you remove those parking requirements, the off-street parking is going to take to the streets. It's going to take to the streets in the neighborhood adjacent to them, and that'll be the other issue that you have to address in the future. You can't restrict that from happening, or businesses will die along the corridor. So it's kind of thing you have to weigh. But, so, I guess this is I'll just stop and ask questions, but if you don't take this back to the City Council and in the future put it on the agenda as an RCA and move to act to initiate either the changes to the land use plan initiation or the change to the zoning, I pointed out that there's some people who would object potentially to the zoning of their property to the B2 district. You could hunt and peck and throw some people out, leave them zone B4 so they're still happy. The world's not going to fall apart if you do that. But the B2 zone, it is an appropriate zone in this area. It's just that this is a constrained urban setting where it still doesn't help it enough that you're going to get development coming in over the counter and everybody's going to want to be able to do it with a permit. So,
yeah. All right, Mr. Hickey.
So I'll have to apologize. I'm trying to remember back to January when apparently this was discussed at a COW. I'm trying to remember, what's the motivation for just, if we've got the comprehensive plan in process, what's the motivation to look at just this one little piece of the city and attempt to fix it as opposed to waiting for the comprehensive plan?
We were asked specifically to look at this by the council. It wasn't, we did not initiate this.
Yeah, I think it's because of the improvements that have been made on the street. What the B2 zoning district will have is some restrictions that the B4 district doesn't have, so it could stop some things from happening that might be inappropriate, if you can imagine what they would be. But that's the one thing that the B2 zoning could do. It won't help promote things necessarily directly, but it would restrict some things. And that list of the things allowed and not allowed, that's the big important part.
I had a question for the city attorney. I'm intrigued by one of the statements in the one of the letters or emails we received. As far as I know, we don't have a property owner developer requesting this change. So the city would be initiating the change. And the comment is made that, in this case, if the city of Rochester mandates a zone change that essentially is not being requested, in their mind that could amount to a legal taking, that because it in their perspective it reduces some of the flexibility of what they can do with the property. Just looking for a reaction, when I see words like taking and things like that, my antenna go up. I don't know if that struck you the same way or that.
Here's what the Minnesota Supreme Court says. A property owner does not acquire a vested right in the existence or continuation of a zoning scheme because there is no vested right in zoning laws. Okay. As long as they have reasonable uses, zoning laws can change after the fact.
Okay.
Despite the fact they may have 15 permitted uses now and that's reduced to 10, does not amount to a taking.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. All right. Who's next?
Mr. Campion. I just wanted for the planning representatives here. I see the action that's. I just want a summary of everything we just went over because it was very informative. And sometimes I lose sight of the forest of the trees here. The staff recommends that the future land use plan map be initiated for revision to identify the low density residential areas as designated for commercial land use. And that's basically sending the message that this is intended long term to be a commercial corridor, not a residential area. Correct. Mm-hmm.
That's those properties on Third Street, the very south end of the project. So that's one item.
Yep. And from your perspective, the same consequence of changing the zoning does not apply to simply changing the land use plan.
No, because land use designation does not have the enforceable. Same effective yep. law.
I just want to make sure.
So it might be easiest if we just carve out that one piece. Discuss that and then move to the next piece, which is potential rezonings. Is there a general consensus that the land use amendment should proceed?
Okay, again, I'm still trying to understand the motivation of doing this ahead of the comprehensive plan. From what I gather just from the public meetings and a little bit of comments we've had, I mean, it doesn't seem like this is being requested. Comprehensive plans can happen. I'm not sure what the motivation is to skip ahead to try to fix this one piece.
Yeah, and this goes back to 2009 when the neighborhood, the business owners, and I started this process. And you might not have been here. We have a stack of papers like this, which were kind of signatures from businesses, property owners who were requesting this overall concept, which was the complete redestruction and the reconstruction and reevaluation of the street along there, which is pretty close to being done now, and then putting zoning along place that created a more pedestrian driven environment. And ultimately, what we did is we had little petitions that we signed, and I've still got them sitting in a file in my office. But a lot of folks were interested in not only making sure we did the road right, but making sure that we took steps to make sure that as the area redeveloped, it was done so in a very pedestrian-friendly manner. I think the summary that you gave on the zoning was good, but I think one thing you didn't touch on were setbacks, and particularly what you can do with pedestrian orientation with the B2 versus the B4. And that's one of the biggest reasons, I think, why it's been pushed in general. And then the other thing, the comprehensive plan will talk about things like land use in general, but it's not going to get into the zoning. That's still years away right now. And what we're trying to do right now is give some tentative guidance for the area that's going to be in place, you know, for these next 3 or 4 years or however long it takes to get new zoning codes into place.
Well, one of the things that in the staff report, I think it's mentioned a couple times, of the individuals that were invited, those that showed up, it doesn't sound like any of the folks that attended want the change. Is that true?
Nobody. I mean, they don't usually get this kind of question.
Yeah.
The city council is going to initiate rezoning of your property. Nobody said that was a good idea.
Yeah, I was there. There were several there that are in favor of it. But like I say, I can pull up the old stack of sheets as well.
Yeah, and I think it's one thing to be supportive in concept, but then if you go talk to Beatles and say, oh, by the way, this is going to make you a non-conforming use, now do you like it? So I think when you get to the specifics of it, people may have a different perspective.
Yeah.
Mr. Campion?
I'm 100% supportive of Ms. Baker's idea that we tackle the two pieces and detangle them, because your statement is more about the zoning. And to me, you know, an integral piece here, if you will take us back again to the land use map, is simply, do we take the time now to send the message to the homeowners that, or property owners or duplex owners that are going to be in this future commercial redevelopment, that you're in a future commercial redevelopment? Or does the council not feel that this corridor should be used as commercial development and thus not send that message? Because that, to me, waiting until the comprehensive plan comes back is somewhat non-pertinent, because that comprehensive plan is not going to redo this line, correct? It could. Okay. Well, then I get it now.
It could be wrapped in that.
So you guys are going to redraw all of the land use maps as part of...
I wouldn't say we're redrawing all lines across the city. We will be looking at the existing land use designations and suggesting modifications to those in different parts of the city.
Okay. So our exposure right now would be, somebody decides to not buy 4 lots on a corner down there and build this as residential instead of commercial. They'd be able to do that without a conditional use permit or without a restricted development process, right?
Well, it's low-density residential now, so yeah, it's very low, basically single-family.
So the zoning map will show that it's zoned R2, they could build 4 plexes.
Okay. Most of those residential units there are owned by someone who has a commercial property in that area, particularly on the first couple blocks. Overwhelmingly, there's people have been acquiring larger parcels around here. There, I don't know what you're seeing for single-family detached home ownership, but there aren't a whole lot of those in there. In fact, a lot of on the south side, a lot of those are actually empty. There's a lot of empty lots right now, and on the north side, I would say that almost all of those are owned by families that have most of the block.
Well, I looked at the ownership of the area. I can tell you stuff if you really want to get in that.
So,
that part of it.
No, but I certainly the first part I don't think is too much of an issue, but part of initiating a process like this, there's an opportunity for them to weigh in. And what I want to avoid is, you know, I want to avoid that, you know, the anti-pedestrian type uses that could go in there. You know, how do we bridge from where we are today? How do we make sure something doesn't go in there that destroys what we've been trying? You know, we put a ton of money trying to achieve in the area.
Mr. Hickey.
So again, timeline-wise, I think we were talking about getting the first preview of the comprehensive plan in August.
We'll be having a discussion about some of the options, I think, August or actually September. So by the end of the year, we'll have a draft.
Right. So, I mean, that's kind of the idea of a comprehensive plan, that we take a comprehensive look as opposed to this little piece and that little piece. So I'd like to take care of it as part of the comprehensive plan. Understand that the zoning will follow.
Well, I mean, would you support a moratorium in this area till that point?
No.
So you just, anything goes until then?
What's been going to date? I mean, is there anything that's really...
Yeah, there's some projects out there, and it's nothing that... And I don't think anyone's proposing putting a fast food restaurant with a drive-thru out there, but it could happen right now, and that's what we'd like to prevent.
Other comments? Mr. Bilderbach, Ms. Mead, Mr. Ruskin?
I guess I'd like to see some support from the area. I don't see, out of all the people that attended, first of all, I'd like to see the list of who signed in, because if we have a dozen property owners, it would be nice. Property neighborhood meetings, when we have developers have them, they show us a list of who that is. That would have been nice to be part of the packet. Second of all, for the fact that all these people are in support, I haven't heard any support for it yet, so I would be happy to see if somebody has letters from everybody showing the support, that we see that as part of it, or it's initiated by some of the people. So with that, I guess, I don't see that this is, there's a lot of property owners here, and I've seen zero right now that are supporting this, so I'm not too excited to take a council-initiated step on this.
Mr. Bilderbach, any comment?
I would like to see the letters from those who are supporting it. I really don't have a problem with rezoning, except for the fact I do have a problem if other people have projects we're shutting it down. I'd be interested in, Mr. Ellerbush said that there's a list of property owners, and I'd just be interested in if those people are buying the property to do some additional buildings and what type of buildings. I'm not totally opposed to the B2, but I would like to see more information before I would support initiating and moving forward. I'd like to see those letters. I'd like to see some of the factual stuff.
There are no letters of support. You have one letter of objection.
Michael has. He said he had
a file. Yeah, that's the names of people.
It's going to be the same stack you've seen several times. I'll bring them again.
I guess, is it pertaining to this redistricting zoning? I guess that's what I'm kind of getting at is, yeah. I've talked to some people that said they weren't as supportive of all this that they've been told. So I think that this is an obvious change that we can say, are you supportive or not? And when you have a dozen, I figured about 20% property owners, and with some of them kicking back, close to 40-50% property owners that showed up, and no one said they supported it. That's what the staff report said. No one spoke in favor of it.
13 property owners showed up, right?
13 out of 70. And then they said they got, 20 back? So 25.
They got 20 back, just returned to Senate.
We got 10, right? We got 11 or 12 back, which is about 20% of 70.
As a return to Senate, though, right? Not as, okay.
Yeah, the only comments we got back in writing were the comments that I attached.
Okay. Ms. Means, any comment?
Thinking about these residential areas, if we don't do anything now, does that mean that the people that currently are in these slots, will they be subject to move or not?
No, they wouldn't, if I understand correctly. They wouldn't have to move or anything like that, but if they were rezoned, if they're... their house burned down, for example, and then they didn't replace it within the prescribed amount of time, they would not be able to build a home there because it would be zoned as commercial. Did I?
Yes.
Okay. That's just one example of, I don't know what it would do as far as the sale of the property. People would, if they're doing their homework, they would find out now it's zoned commercial versus residential. I don't know if that would compromise the sale or not.
I suspect it would.
Pardon?
Can you talk about that moratorium? Why did you suggest that?
We invested a ton of money out there to create a pedestrian-friendly environment, and we want to make sure that what goes in there creates a pedestrian-friendly environment. And
the, you know, putting some zoning in place that prescribes that is one way of doing that. And if we're not willing to do that, a moratorium until we have the comprehensive plan or other zoning is another way to do that. But, you know, if you take no action, you run the risk of, you know, getting a development that, you know, fits the fits what's allowed but not what's desired.
All right, so what's your pleasure as far as staff direction? I'll start and I'll kind of follow on with what Mr. Hickey was saying, which is I don't see the rush. I'm willing to wait for the land use plan and zoning to follow through. I'm not seeing the urgency, but so I would opt for no change at this point.
I will go along with that unless I can see the letters that show that the support of the landlords would like a change. Otherwise, at this point, I'd be willing to say no change. But I would be willing to re-entertain that at a later date if I saw those letters.
Yeah.
Currently, I'd say no change.
I would state my position, right?
I guess I'd be in favor of taking a look at the land use for that area, just to be forthright with some of the property owners over there. I think that's a pretty simple, obvious change here that could be delivered. It's recommended by staff. It sends a clear message about development. The zone change, I think, is maybe going to need a little bit more work. I'd support, bringing it back if we could get some clear support from some of the properties in the area, but it's a pretty big hill to climb. Rezoning a property without anyone supporting it, I think it is a little bit far from the go. So.
All right.
Yeah, the discussion surprised me a little bit. I'll go out and, bring back some of those supporters. They were all in here talking about this stuff when we initiated the Uptown project, so that's, I'll get them back again.
Ms. Means?
Yeah, no, it sounds reasonable to wait for the comprehensive plan. I'm a little bit concerned about these residential properties here.
Mr. Ruskin.
Yeah, I'm sort of holding off on this.
All right. So it sounds like we'll stand pat on that one unless new information comes to light that would prompt us to revisit the topic.
Just a follow-up. So you said as part of the comprehensive plan, we'll be possibly redrawing a bunch of these.
I don't want to overstate that. So existing land use designations.
I think
adjusting adjustments in places where it's appropriate.
Okay, so how do you foresee us going through this list of adjustments? Because part of the problem I see is if each one of these, we have to take them one by one. How are we going to handle that?
Right. So the first step in this process is really looking at the big picture. Is there going to be a different approach to looking at concentrating growth in corridors and nodes so that there's better support for more frequent, reliable transit service? We're trying to tie these together. Because without the right command for transit service, you're not going to get ridership. And if you don't have the ridership, you can't justify frequent, reliable service. And you're hearing from the community, they want more service, and they want it in the evenings, and they want it on the weekends. You can't accomplish that without tying your land use patterns and your growth patterns together with it. So big picture questions are going to come to you first. Are we going to look at concentrating our growth in these nodes and corridors so that we can tie that better together with transit service? If the answer to that is yes, then we'll come back to you with, here's where we think those highest priority areas are based on priority transit corridors first, those that are existing and those that have potential for developing. Again, looking at the real logistics of operating public transit and the financial side of that and how that ties together with land use. And then we'll have that conversation around, are you comfortable with changing this commercial zoning boundary or land use boundary from here to here or from here to here? But we can't get to that level of discussion until we have the bigger picture discussion first. So It's going to come to you, I think, in stages. We kind of have to pick it apart. But one of the challenges is, when you get to the fine-grained discussion, it's hard to step back and go, we have to look at the greater good in the bigger picture and the long-term goals. It's easy to get confused with the details of a specific site.
So just a quick
project?
So how do we keep ourselves from, we'll come with some broader recommendations, which staff will then implement. How do we keep ourselves from micromanaging, you know, down to the individual parcel when this plan comes out? Because basically, there's the potential to, you know, re-envision the community through the comprehensive plan, you know, 30 years overdue in my book. But and everybody's going to take a look, you know, 50,000 parcel owners in Rochester are going to take a look and say, I don't like this one and I like this one. Are these going to be brought forward as a package to us so we can yay or nay on the big picture, or are we going to sit down and negotiate
first step
all these?
Will be coming forward with this, the bigger, broader questions of overall approach to future development and growth. If you say we don't want to change anything, we're not interested in looking at transit corridors or nodes, the transit piece is a low priority, let's go with greenfield development, it's a whole different conversation and a very different approach to the plan. So we have to get through that phase first. When we get further down the line, I think the important thing is when you start having debates about, I don't want this in my neighborhood, I don't want this in my neighborhood, if you know you need to have it in your community, your overall plan should be addressing that and looking at a more fair distribution and avoiding concentrations of uses that people typically don't want, okay? So that's where when you get down to the neighborhood or ward level, you maybe have to just emphasize that the bigger picture is part of what's driving your decision. I don't know if that's all.
Yeah, I guess the reason I asked is just I want to understand if we're, and this phrase may not be to your liking, but if we're going to be kicking the can to when the comprehensive plan gets done, I'd like to understand when that's actually going to get done. Because that's, I know you're bringing back a draft and that's fine, but I want to understand how these things are going to get queued up behind. Because I don't actually, I guess, no matter what happens, it seems like these property owners that abut these properties that would be changed are going to have a vested interest in coming and hearing about that. Is it going to be part of a bulk 200 property change, or is it going to be part of these specific areas being changed? It sounds like you're still working through the specifics, so I'll let you off the hook today, but would like to understand what that looks like in the future.
So the first phase is that land use amendment. The zoning comes after that, and that's probably where you're going to have more heated debates over, do we rezone the properties now or wait until the property owners are ready? Set the land use plan so that it encourages these changes and let that come as the market moves along.
Sure.
All right, Mr. Newman.
That's the big picture. On the little picture, this is a former township area. We've run into this before, I think in 1995, when we redid the plan then. I think we had certain pockets where we looked at, it was the zoning still appropriate. I believe we ran into it down on Marion Road when we annexed a bunch of those properties in conjunction with the some of the sewer and water things that were going on down there. So there does seem to be, you know, in areas close to the city that were formerly township that might have allowed kind of a certain kind of commercial use or a mixture of districts in there. We seem to run into this and haven't run into it before. So this may be one we may have to look at as a specific area back. You know, at the time you do the comp plan, this may be one of a couple of areas like this you have to look at. So.
All right. Anything else for the good of the cause this afternoon? We are adjourned.